Today's Taisho will be on case 95 in the Book of Serenity. Linji's One Stroke. Introduction. When a Buddha comes, he strikes. When a devil comes, he strikes. If they have a reason, 30 blows. If they have no reason, 30 blows. Is this misapprehending enemies, or is it not distinguishing the good? Try to say. Case. Linji asked the temple superintendent, "Where are you coming from?" He said, "From selling rice in the city." Linji said, "Did you sell it all?" The superintendent said, "Sold it all." Linji drew a stroke with his staff and said, "Did you sell this one?" The superintendent immediately shouted. Linji thereupon hit him. Subsequently, the cook came and brought up the preceding story and said to Linji, "The superintendent didn't understand your meaning." Linji said, "And how about you?" The cook immediately bowed. Linji hit him too. Verse. Linji's whole dynamic, the character and tone are high. On the staff is an eye which can distinguish the finest hair. Sweeping out the foxes and rabbits, family tradition is strict. Transforming fish into dragons, lightning fire burns, the life-giving sword, the death-dealing sword. Leaning against the sky, shining on the snow, sharp enough to sever a hair blown against it. Equally, the orders carried out, but tasting differs. Where it's totally painful, who is it that experiences it? Some of you may not be familiar with Linji, so I want to just say a little bit about Master Linji, who is the main figure in this Taisho, in this koan. Linji is really considered one of the greatest Zen masters of the Tang and Sung dynasties. What really one of the in his own time, he was greatly admired by other awakened practitioners as somebody who had deeply integrated into his life the experience of awakening or the reality of awakening. Different teachers at that time had different styles, and it's quite remarkable that the Tang Dynasty really saw quite a few astonishing teachers. So in Linji's time, or roughly in his time, we have Linji's teacher, Wang Bo. We have Joshu, and Joshu's teacher, Nansen, or Nanchuan, and Zhao Zhu, and a great many other astonishingly awake people this time. Really quite a remarkable moment in world history. And Linji was thought to be among that group, that very distinguished group, really exemplary. And his style was quite distinctive. Joshu, another great Zen master, Zhao Zhu, was famous for being very kind, very straightforward. Apparently, when he spoke, it was quite moving. Zhao Zhu was supposed to be just quite a powerful speaker, very deeply moving, very clear, very humane, gentle. That was his style. That was how he integrated awakened mind into his practice of teaching and into his practice of Zen. Linji had a totally different style. Linji was famous for this very dynamic, almost explosive style in Zen. And he was famous for yelling and hitting people. He would have been, if he lived today, he'd be the subject of many lawsuits and things like that, and probably with good reason. I don't know. Certainly, I don't think it's appropriate to practice that style of Zen anymore. But he helped a lot of people to wake up with this very dynamic style. He was the kind of person you might not want to study with, as a matter of fact. You know, I would have liked to study with Zhao Zhu, not that I would have been particularly worthy of studying with Zhao Zhu, but he was so kind, supposed to be so kind and gentle and so generous and so on. I think he would have put you at ease and just said, here, just do Mu and everything will be okay. You know, don't worry, just enter Mu. In fact, you know, in a way, our tradition, the particular tradition I trained in, is considered a Linji lineage, coming from Master Linji. But in many ways, we actually practice Zhao Zhu or Joshu Zen, because of course we all start with the Mu koan. So even though we don't call ourselves Joshu Zen, we're really practicing very much a sort of Joshu style Zen. And I think I love that style of Zen. Just be in Mushin and let everything else take care of itself. That's just great. I love that. I mean, I love Zhao Zhu. I love Joshu. I think I would be a little afraid of Linji, you know, to tell you the truth. I'm kind of glad I didn't run into him. You know? So it could still happen, I guess. But you know, his style was very different. You know, Linji could probably be a pain in the ass, I think, you know. Because he didn't like to let people relax too much. You know what I mean? His style wasn't to let you relax. It was to keep you off balance. So Linji's style was always probing into his students and always trying to find out sort of what their weak point was, you know. Always pushing them on their weaknesses. You know, basically, if you prided your, let's say you started doing Zen 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and it was hard for you to sit. You know, that's how it was for me too. When I started doing Zen practice, it was very hard for me to sit. I had a lot of physical pain. And maybe for that reason, I really decided to try to sit well, you know, to be good at this, because it was, didn't come naturally to me at all. So I used to practice sitting full lotus. And sometimes I would just try to sit for 5 minutes, and then I'd add a couple minutes. And sometimes I would actually just be rocking with pain, you know. But I wanted to learn how to do this. And I would just, you know, go as far as I could, and then when I was in pain, I shouldn't have moved, but I would just move, like sort of rock back and forth, just to get through a couple more minutes, you know, maybe. And little by little, you can do 5 minutes, then you can do 7 minutes, then you can do 10 minutes, then you can do 15 minutes, and so on. But it was hard for me. So maybe you're that kind of person, and maybe after 5 or 6 years, you know, you begin to sit very well. You come in on the cushion, you sit down, body is nicely balanced, back is straight, and you know, hands folded, head straight, perfect, you know, perfect posture. So then you go in to see Master Linji in Dokusan and you sit down on the cushion and basically you get into your beautiful practice, your beautiful posture, your beautiful Zen posture. You want to show the master that you've worked so hard and you've accomplished so much. See, and Linji's style would be to say something like, you know, your practice really stinks. You know, your posture is all wrong. You're just doing this whole thing wrong. See? And then you would come out of the Dokusan room thinking, what? My posture's... I've been working on this for 5 years, right? And you might get really mad. You might think, well, you know, how dare he say that? See, and Linji would love that. See, if you got really mad, you go, how dare he? You know, many people say I sit well. You know, my last teacher said I sat beautifully. That bastard, you know? And he was very small, so it'd be that little bastard, you know? And he got under people's skin, you know? That was his style, to get under your skin. So if you had just answered the mukoan and you went to see Master Linji, you know, maybe you answered the mukoan with another teacher, seeing you go in to do Dokusan with Master Linji, and you'd say, I'm working on hot water, cold water. Master Linji might say, what's that? And you try to explain the koan to him, and you go, I never heard of that koan. See? You'd say, somebody passed you on mu? You? You passed? No, that was a big mistake. Right? I don't know who your teacher is, but he's an idiot too. See? And you'd go out of the Dokusan room, you'd either go out of the Dokusan room mad at him, that little bastard, or you'd go out thinking, oh, what an idiot I am, I'm such a failure, you know? So this was Linji's style, you know, whatever you held on to, he would take away from you, you know, actively. And that was his style, you know. So I think he was a real pain in the ass in a lot of ways. And it must have been hair-raising to practice with him because he kept you off balance all the time. My personal feeling is that this is not a good strategy for training people in our time. I actually never do that. And it's a deliberate decision on my part. And I will never do it. You know, I promise you that it's not my style. And I really am in a Linji lineage, but I really practice a Zhaozhu Zen, Joshu Zen. Let's just sit together and move. Everything will take care of itself in the readiness of time. Yeah, everything is just like fruit ripening. If you just keep coming back to mu, everything will. But all the same, even though I don't have a sort of karmic affinity for Linji Zen, and I don't think it's an appropriate way to teach, for many reasons, I think it's not good psychologically for modern people, because we're already kept very much off balance. And I also think that it's rather dangerous because it gives so much power to the teacher. You know, my feeling is that people are constantly kept off balance by the teacher. They never know, you know, where they stand, and I think that gives the teacher too much power. My personal feeling is that can lead to abuses of authority. You know, so maybe the teacher's taking advantage of you, and you think, oh, he's doing this so I can wake up. No, he's just exploiting you. Maybe, you know, how do you know? I think that it's not good for many reasons. I could go on and on about this, but I do think that Linji did have some very valuable lessons to teach us all the same, because it is the case that when we're off balance, when we're hurting, when we're frightened, when we're standing at the edge of a cliff thinking, can I jump over? You know, anything can. That's a most wonderful moment. That's really like the best moment for practice. See, so Linji kind of pushed people right there. He put people right there. You know, so if you were, thinking you had gotten somewhere in Zen, he'd say, oh, you're really confused. You know, you're really just a beginner. He'd say that to somebody who's been practicing for 20 years. That's an answer a beginner would give. You'd leave the Dokusan room thinking, oh my God, 20 years down the tubes, you know. Or you'd think, that little bastard. So let's Linji style, pull the rug out. See, and my feeling is life pulls the rug out, right? Life You don't need the teacher to do that. It's always happening. Life pulls the rug out all the time. And when life pulls the rug out, however, that's a really special moment, right? Because when life pulls the rug out from under us, we're very open and very we might be very frightened, but very open. And in that moment, you know, the true self can come out. We hold it inside. We cover it up with layers and layers and layers. But in those special moments, it can come out. So what we have here is a koan in which Lin Ji is picking away at the superintendent. See, the superintendent is like a very advanced student. He does a really, you know, I wouldn't want to tangle with Lin Ji, but this guy does very well with Lin Ji. So Lin Ji sees him, and he's a senior monk in the temple, and he starts picking on him, trying to find his weak spots, right? He says, "Where are you coming from?" And he said, I've just been selling rice. You know, I mentioned a couple weeks ago that during Jaru's ordination, I mentioned that in China, monks and nuns had to work, and they often grew rice and things, and in this case the temple's selling some of the rice it grew in the city. So Lin Ji asked the temple superintendent, "Where are you coming from?" He said, "I've been selling rice in the city." Lin Ji said, "Did you sell it all?" See, now this is really not just about rice. This is a question about, are you clinging to anything? See, are you clinging to anything? Are you completely free of karmic obstacles, those psychological barriers in ourselves? And he doesn't even hesitate. He said, "Sold it all. It's all gone." So Lin Ji's not going to be happy with it. That's a good, wonderful response, by the way. I mean, if it's true. And this guy just naturally says, there's no obstacle. So Lin Ji draws a line in the dirt with his staff, and he says, "Did you sell this one?" So again, the superintendent doesn't hesitate. He just goes, "Moo!" Okay? So Lin Ji hit him, right? And Lin Ji would just hit you like that, right? Okay. So what does that mean that Lin Ji hit him? Does that mean the answer was good? Does it mean the answer was bad? You know, that's part of the koan. So subsequently, the cook came after this incident, got all over the temple, right? I mean, this is like the gossip in the temple. Everybody said, "Oh, did you hear? You know, Lin Ji and the superintendent went, you know, head to head. And how did the superintendent come out?" "Oh." You know, so the cook came and brought up the story with Lin Ji, and he said, "The superintendent, he just didn't understand your very profound meaning, Lin Ji." So Lin Ji said, "Oh, yeah?" So he's probing in. "How about you?" See, looking for the weak spot. The cook bows to show that he understands, and Lin Ji hit him too. So who had the right answer? Who had the wrong answer? This is called Lin Ji's one stroke. See, so this is Lin Ji in his prime, doing his thing, practicing in his way, helping people to wake up with his very abrupt style, pulling the rug out from everybody, from under everybody. So he sees the superintendent, he tries to pull the rug out from his feet. He sees the cook comes in and he tries to pull the rug out from under his feet. And he's always doing that. You know, that's Lin Ji's style, is try to pull it out from under you. You think you're standing stable, you think you're getting somewhere in your practice, you think you have some insight. He tries to push you right over the cliff, right? And that's his method. I just don't think it works very well. I think it has many problems, but he's got a point, you know? Lin Ji has a point. When we're handed a difficult, painful event by life, when life, you know, the teacher doesn't have to slap you in the face. Life is going to slap you in the face, right? Life is going to slap you in the face. And when it does, really wonderful things. That moment is like the most important moment. It's the most important moment. Because that's when you can really wake up. That's when you can really wake up. You know, I woke up this morning and I was thinking about my brother again. My brother, some of you might know, died a little while ago, in March, as a matter of fact. He had cancer. And he was sick for a long time. You know, I got up this morning thinking about him, because I do miss my brother, you know, and he's truly gone. And I was remembering a particular incident. I'd already decided to talk about this koan last night when I went to bed. I have this volume by my bed. I have another copy. And I was looking at it last night. And I decided to do this koan. And then I went to sleep. And then around 3:30 in the morning, I woke up because it was, I think it was like 85 degrees in the room, for one thing. And I got a drink of water, and then I started thinking about my brother. And you know, when my brother was young, he's quite different person. It's funny how people can come from the same family, same mother, same father, and be rather different. You know, my brother, I have to tell you the truth, I'm a Democrat, you know? And I really am a kind of a socialist, to tell you the truth. I really am. I mean, actually, I'm not kind of a socialist. I really. And you don't have to be one. You know, I understand there's many arguments against it, but I kind of like the idea of people. My interpretation of this is people holding other people up, helping other. Some people would say keeping other people down. Right. So I understand, but it's my personal. It has nothing to do with Zen practice. It's my personal politics, you know. So my brother is strangely Republican, right, and a businessman. And maybe he had to have his particular outlook on the world to function in the world he lived in. You know, I work in a university. Everybody's on the left, pretty much. So it's pretty safe to say I'm a socialist. In fact, people would just have contempt for me for not being hardcore enough. Only a socialist? You know. Too wishy-washy. You know. You know, my brother was a Republican, and he has a very interesting, you know, he's like an avid hunter. My brother was a hunter, which I have never done. My father tried to take me hunting, and I just couldn't stand it. Unfortunately, I'm a terrible shot, so I never could hit anything, and then I was released from the agony of having to go hunting. But my brother loved hunting, and he was a very politically conservative person, you know. And he had a style. He was very funny. He had an incredible sense of humor. And he was he was just like a kind of a funny, tough guy, you know. And I don't know how to put it, except he was sort of funny and he was kind of tough. And he could make a joke out of things that I thought were sort of hard-hearted a little bit. It bothered me because, you know, when I had been growing up with him, I had seen another side of my brother, which was, you know, a little kid who loved animals. My brother used to collect turtles and put them in a little pen for them in the backyard and feed them raw hamburger, box turtles, you know. And so he loved animals when he was a little kid, you know. And he had, of course, like all human beings, had this wonderful compassion and kindness inside himself. But as he got older, it just seemed to get locked up, which is very common, right? I mean, this happens to everybody. My brother, at one point in his life, was going to marry this woman, it's sort of a typical situation also. He really was in love with this person for a number of more than a year. She was unfaithful to him. My brother called me up on the phone one day, and he was sobbing. You know, he was actually sobbing. And when I listened to my brother, It was like hearing the voice of my little brother again. It was like he was a little kid, and I could hear that, you know, he was hurting so much, and he was so kind, and there was such sort of a broken-hearted love in what, you know, he was talking about our mother, he was talking about our sister, he was, he was just like pulsating with love, with compassion. And he was having a really hard time dealing with this. I think he felt really injured by this experience. But the funny thing is, it stayed with me, because it's like his true nature came out at that moment. He was really injured. He loved this woman, and he trusted her obviously very much, and she did not Well, she betrayed his trust, yeah? Which happens all the time. But, basically, when he was slapped in the face like that, you know, this beautiful creature came out. You know, this was like the face, we would say in Archer, the face of Buddha, right? Just there, plain as day. After that injury, and I was so happy to see that person again, because I hadn't seen him in so many years. And for a little while, he was calling me regularly, and we were talking on the phone. For a little while, I don't remember how long, but he was really like, you know, he was that person. And then, you know, it was almost like this. He closed up again. One day I called him up, and it was like I was talking to the wisecracking tough guy again. It was just astounding to me. I guess I shouldn't have been so shocked, but I wanted that other person to stay for a while. I thought, maybe this is it. Maybe he's really going to change, you know, to be a different person. Of course, I have no right to expect that. It's everybody's individual choice. But it was so wonderful to see that person, that other person again. But then, you know, he was back to like the tough guy again. And he was funny. Had this wonderful, irreverent, funny, sort of slightly cynical sense of humor. I was so sorry to see the other person gone. It's not really gone, but it's down in there, covered up under all these layers. You know, so this is what happens to all of us. You know, as we go through our lives, we gradually become closed up to defend ourselves. I mean, everybody goes through this process of maturation, right? Growing up, and when you're a little kid, you're not enlightened, but you're not so afraid. You don't know enough about life to be so distrustful of life. So little things seem amazing and just wonderful. I mean, I can remember going into the woods with my brother looking for turtles, you know. And that was like, I have seldom done anything so amazing in my life as hunting turtles. Now, box turtles are almost gone now from the Northeast. Environmental degradation, habitat loss, all those things have made you almost never see them. But when we were kids, you could go into the woods and find them all over the place. If you just walked around the woods, you'd come across a beautiful box. They're beautiful animals with big round shells, and their legs have orange spots on them. They're ancient beings, right? Just beautiful. And we would hunt these turtles and bring them back, and my mother would let us keep them for a little while. We had to let them go. But we'd feed them lettuce and hamburger. You know, and turtles have big beaks, you know, like big beaks, and the long neck, they'd be in the thing, you'd put the hamburger out, and we'd just sit there and watch. The turtle's head would open up, right? It closes up. They can close up completely, you know. So they're just like they close up. You can't even see their legs. So then the shell opens a little bit, and he looks out, right?
Then the shell goes down, the bottom goes down, the head comes out, the legs come out. Then he goes over to the hamburger and the long neck, right? And then and it's like when he eats it, you can almost taste it yourself, right? Right? It's like that. It's like you could he bites the hamburger, but you're biting with him, you know? And then he eats it. You can just taste that hamburger. In fact, you know, we did before we gave it to him, we tasted some raw hamburger ourselves. You know? And then the lettuce, you know, and it's so good. Finally, he sort of trusts you, so you can sort of stick that lettuce leaf up, and he bites it, you know, and those were the days when all the lettuce in the store was iceberg lettuce, right? So he would just bite that, and then it would leave sometime a little beak-shaped tear in the lettuce. That was just amazing. That's, of course, that's, we lose, you know, as we grow up, we lose that capacity to just identify with the world in an unqualified way, to become the turtle, right? Just amazing. Turtles are like magical beings, right? They're ancient beings that live in the forest. Their species is what? I don't know. 50 million years old? I mean, 100 million years old? I have no idea, but ancient, ancient, long before humans were here, there were turtles. So you find this ancient being in the forest and you put it in your little pen and you feed it hamburger. We would be unable to sleep sometimes thinking about turtles. That's just a wonderful way to live, actually. But as you grow up, you know, somebody tells you, turtles, what's that all about, you know? And you realize, oh, that's for kids, right? So you stop going out in the woods, and you have to get records instead, and you go out in the, if you go out in the woods, it's to smoke cigarettes with your friends, right? And somebody steals a beer, and you drink a beer out in the woods. And little by little, you know, you just lose that capacity to have like unqualified identification with the world. And partly you lose it because you're constantly trying to be what other people want you to be. You know, so you're gradually adjusting, developing this identity. You realize that I need to be this way. I shouldn't be that way. So this is going on. At the same time, you're having painful experiences, right? As we grow up, we have these painful experiences. And we learn and get very good at, or better anyway, at protecting ourselves, at avoiding pain. And that usually means don't make yourself vulnerable, right? Don't go out on a limb. Don't be too open. We learn how to stay strategically closed up. And we get very safe, but we gradually find that there's like this graying of life. Right? It's like the colors washed out of our lives. And you see a turtle one day. You say, oh yeah, a turtle, yeah. It's hard to recall what it was like to experience this wonderful creature from the forest. Everything becomes like that after a while. Everything becomes like that. One way to think about Zen practice is we're trying to undo some of that damage. You know, and often the moment when we can undo it most dramatically, most effectively, is that moment when we've suffered some kind of an injury, you know, or an insult, or things aren't going the way we want. But especially if it feels like the universe has just slapped us in the face, you know. I actually had I've talked about this in the past, but I actually had my great so-called Daikensho, Great Awakening experience, at a terrible time in my life. I had gotten my PhD, and I couldn't get a job. I was on the job market, and I just I started out sending letters of application to places like the University of Chicago, and I would get turned down, and you know, I had dreamed of going to a place like that, and then by the end I was sending letters to, you know, Community College of the Desert, and you know, and there's nothing wrong with teaching there, but I had undergone a dramatic a transformation in my expectations, and guess what, you know, they turned me down too, you know. So I really thought, my gosh, I've gone through 7 years of graduate school or 8 years of graduate school, and I can't get a job, and I'm going to be moving furniture again for the Mayflower Moving Company or something, which is sort of my summer job sometime. And also, our Zen group was in a state of civil war. Our community was in a state of civil war. And also, well, we were losing our temple because of the civil war. We were going sort of bankrupt. We were a nonprofit, and we had a big mortgage. And so all of this was coming down on me in particular because I was the treasurer at the time. And I went to a session, and I just felt so slapped in the face by life, you know. When this happens, you know, you just have to jump, you know. I was trying to decide whether I should go to the session or not after we began to have all these problems in our Zen group. As I say, we were losing our temple because we couldn't pay the mortgage. There was like this bitter civil war going on in our community, which happens to communities all over the world all the time. And I was having these personal problems, and somebody asked me, do you want to go to session? And I just thought, I don't know. You know, I've kind of had it with Zen, you know, because of all these troubles in our group, and I wasn't sure. And I felt like life had just slapped me in the face, and it was like, screw life, you know, I'm not even gonna try anymore. But the interesting thing was that I decided to go to the session, you know, I decided to do it. And a wonderful thing happened at that session. This is like Linji's one stroke, right? It's like when you're slapped in the face, you know, your whole being is insulted, you're in pain, whatever. Now, if you can just reach out and trust, if you can just trust a little bit and just give it a try, whatever it is, just give it a try. See, that's Linji's one stroke. Just try. You know, just trust a little tiny bit. And the most wonderful things can happen to you. Just trust a little tiny bit. Some people here, a couple people who are here today, are here for your first half day of sitting. And I want to congratulate you. You survived, you know, so far, and there's only like 5 minutes left in the Teisho. So you made it, you know. Probably a few days ago, if you thought about this, you would have said, I can't do this, you know. And I can't do it. And maybe life didn't slap you in the face this time, but maybe you had some hard sits, yeah? But the important thing is that in the presence of uncertainty, fear, or injury, you just try. See, just try. Just act. And see, you know, you never know what's going to happen. This is not so different from the Mu koan, right? You're sitting in Mu, and your mind is totally blank, and all you have to do is just act. Just trust life just a little tiny bit. Just go into Dogasan and do something. It doesn't matter what. Just try. And then, you know, the universe can possess your body. You know, it's like divine possession.
You know, that's if you just try just a tiny little bit, the most wonderful thing can happen. See, that's Linji's one stroke. So it's like, you know, Linji slaps people in the face. You know, he goes around and he pulls the rug out from under them. And sometimes a lot of them just lie there. He pulls the rug out and they just lie there. You know, and it's because they don't trust, right? But you lie there long enough and you think, well, why am I lying here? Why don't I just give it a try? You know, when life knocks us down, we go, boo-hoo. I'm such a victim. I'm so, I didn't deserve this, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This happens to all of us, whatever happens. I was, this is not a dramatic story, but Thursday morning after my sit, I got up and I had to fix the faucet in my shower, which was leaking like crazy. And I fixed it three or four times before. But this time you take the handle off the shower and the cartridge is inside this sleeve. And you have to put a wrench on the sleeve and turn it. But the sleeve was frozen because of mineral deposits in there. But I didn't know that. And I turned it, and it didn't give, so I turned it even harder. And I, like, ripped the whole unit out of the wall. You know? So I had no water, right? I mean, I'd already turned the water off, fortunately. So there was no water. I had to call the plumber. I had a meeting at 10 o'clock, you know. So I had to go to the gym. My wife had to go to her gym and get ready for work. And I had to go to my gym and, you know, you think, why today? Why me? You know, boo-hoo. We all do it, right? We all do, why me? Why today of all days? You know, I'm such a victim. You know? I'm an innocent bystander, you know. Why did this... But, you know, sometimes it's serious. You know. But when that happens, you know, if you just trust enough, you get knocked down enough, and you just lie there. Eventually, you can get mad. But eventually, you realize, you know, why don't I just trust? Why don't I just try? And why don't I just try? Who knows what will happen? You know, this is just like so many things in life. This is one stroke. You know? Just let me try. I don't know what's going to happen, but let me just try. Let me just act. It's like I have to write. I'm an English teacher, and I have to write. I'm working on a project right now. I've been working on this chapter for a month, and I write a couple pages, and I just throw them in the trash. I've thrown away at least as much as I've written. And, but you just have to sit, you get up in the morning, sit on the cushion, you go to your word processor, and you just try. And I've been sort of in a dry spell for like a week, you know, or more than that. And all of a sudden, the other day, I was writing, and I just got it. You know, it was like catching the wave. It was like catching the wave. And it's so sweet. It's like, wow, I've caught the wave. You know, tomorrow could be gone again, and I'm back in the sand. But it was so sweet, and it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't tried. You know, there's no guarantees, but you just have to keep coming back to the word processor, and you just have to try, right? You fail, and you fail, and you fail, and you fail. And when you fail, you get mad, you feel like a victim, you go through all of these. You can close up. But if you just say, okay, you know, whatever happens is Buddha. My legs hurt, yes, Buddha. Another way to put it is, you know, thy will be done, right? Whatever happens is Buddha, thy will be done. See, that's the essence of Zen practice. That's Linji's one stroke. I'll try. I don't know what's gonna happen, but I'll try. I'll act. So Linji asked the temple superintendent is somebody who has been knocked on his ass a million times by life, maybe by Linji. and he's used to it, and he doesn't take it personally, and he doesn't get mad. He lives in mushin. He lives in emptiness, you know? And so he's if you live in emptiness, see, you can have a tender heart all the time, or a lot of the time. It's
that's the advantage of living in emptiness. You know, you're not don't close up. So he has like tender heart, trust in life, right? Trust. So Linji asks the temple superintendent, "Where are you coming from?" He doesn't hesitate. He says, "Selling rice in the city." Linji said, "Did you sell it all?" He said, "Sold it all." See, if he stopped to think, is it the right answer or not? Uh-oh, this is Linji. I better give the right answer. See, this hopeless situation. You'll never give the right answer. He just acts. He lives in emptiness and he acts. So the open heart act. You say, how do I know it's the right act? Don't worry about it. Just act. Cultivate mushin. Cultivate empty mind. Cultivate empty mind. Empty mind produces open heart. And then just act. See. So he just says, I sold it all. I'm not holding on to anything right now. I'm in mushin. My heart is open. So Linji said, oh, okay, good. Let's test it out. Linji draws Linji shows, I'll show you open heart. Shh. Line in the dirt. He didn't think about it either. Just in mushin and acts. See, did you sell this one? Superintendent is in mushin and he acts. Linji hit him. No, Linji didn't hit him because the answer's right or the answer's wrong. Linji hit him because his heart is open. See, just in mushin, open heart, act. In mushin, open heart, act. See, and you say, well, how do you know if it's the right action? Then you don't trust. See, trust, trust, trust. Of course, it takes a lot of zazen to have that kind of openness. So please keep practicing. Very important. You know, humans are not naturally open, or let me take that back. Humans are naturally open. As we grow all up, as we grow up, we all, without exception, close up, right? So we have to all work very hard, to return to our natural state. That's what I should have said. And that's the truth. Because if it wasn't our natural state, no amount of zazen would make it possible to get there, right? If that weren't our natural state, see, you could sit from now until doomsday and you'd never open up. But the truth is, you know, when my brother called me on the phone in tears, that's his natural self. That's the self I knew when he was 4 years old, right? Love, compassion, you know. So naturally Buddha, naturally open, naturally trusting, naturally loving. But close up. So we all have to work, all have to do zazen. But every once in a while, you know, you open up. And then it's just heaven, right? It's heaven. Heaven on earth, heaven itself. There is no other heaven. That's it.